But I want to remind people that hard, if you're working hard, hard things are going to happen. You're going to be confronted with friction if you're trying new stuff. You just got to push through, because that's what everybody that we watch and listen to, that we look up to, Elon, Cardone, all of the guys, Stocko, they all went through hard stuff. If we want to get to where they are or feel the way they feel, we're going to have to do some of what they did.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Business Aspirin. I'm your host, Clint Janelle, a podcast where we talk about business pains and try to find nuggets of information to help you overcome those pains. And as a result, I'm super excited to have one of my favorite people in the restoration industry, Clark Brown, with us today. Clark is with Restoration Advisors, and he's got a storied past in the restoration space, and he has a lot of valuable information that he could share. And we're going to see if we can dig some of that out today. Clark, my friend, welcome to the podcast.
Reporting for duty. Hello, Clint. Thank you for the introduction. And I share that you are one of my favorite. You have a lot of different skills and you have your hands in a lot of different things. And I always know that when I see you speaking, it's usually worthy. So thanks for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely, dude. I'm excited about this one. Clark is one of those people that always has your back. Like, Clark's a guy that, you know, you friend Clark and you, you know, he likes to be around good people. And when you have a friend in Clark, you know that he's looking out for you. And that's not always the case in this space. It's not always the case in business. So, Clark, I'm super excited to have you on, man. Thank you again for joining. Let's talk a little bit about, you know, this is the second round for Clark to be on the Business Aspirin podcast, you know, the first version that we did. But let's just talk about Clark. Like, who is Clark? How did you get into restoration? How did you get into entrepreneurship? And let's just kind of venture down that path a little bit.
Well, let's start with entrepreneurship. It was a natural path. It was kind of my father. My parents were entrepreneurs in East Texas. And man, just the idea of working for someone else did never seem like the best option for me. I can't really explain why, since it was embedded in me. And I had a very independent, I was a Gen Z latchkey kid, they call them. I mean, I had the freedom and the roam, and I became very independent at an early age. And that just kind of added to the character of an entrepreneur is independent, can kind of figure anything out, or at least think they can to a degree. I was in the family business for the first period of my year after college, got into dry cleaning, laundry and dry cleaning in Texas. Our slogan for our dry cleaners was the best place in town to drop your pants. It was popular with some, it wasn't popular with others, but I've always found business to be creative and fun, and you got to be memorable. So I weaved through that industry a little bit, had some other side businesses. Some failed, most failed. I thought for some reason that a good investment was to get into an HVAC supply company with a partner. And number one, learned that partners are difficult. And number two, I didn't know anything enough about that business to make it work with the cash I needed to spend. Had cleaners all through my career, moved it into this space adjacent with the textile cleaning, and then grew that and sold that to a group, that a network now, that wanted to have a location in this city in Texas, where the mold is gold days were great for the P&L. And I jumped into the disaster company in 02. One of my clients said, hey, why don't you join us at the ground level of this thing and let's do it. I knew very little about what it really meant to be a disaster recovery specialist. And here we are, what is that, 23 years later. I've worked for other people, had in that time built and sold my own for a couple of years. I was mostly in the commercial space, as you know, Clint, actually all in the commercial space. And then when I sold my business, I really was at that point in my 40s. What do I do with the rest of my life? Being a hunting and fishing guide was something I wanted to do, but it just didn't seem like the thing. And I just had a long month where I said, what do I love to do? And I just have always loved coaching, mentoring, teaching. People call me for advice. And it just kind of clicked. I said, could that be a living? Could that be a career of doing what you love to do? And we have. And we're 8 years into our agency and growing, shifting. This year is different than the past, but the needs always change of who we like to work with. So we just evolve with that. Having the time of my life, Clint. I mean, you mentioned it. Our ethos of our company is tribe. We really, really choose to work with only people that fire us up, not burn us out. And that That's hard. This means a lot of no's and a lot of revenue loss. But the end all net profit of that, the double bottom line, is just fulfillment and the energy to keep going. So I would say that's my short version of a longish version of a journey.
Yeah, sure. But you've got some really good people that you're working with right now. And I think that is a testament to your character and what you're building over there. So let's tell everybody what it is that you do. What is Restoration Advisors?
Restoration Advisors specifically, right now in our current iteration, we work with only people in the companies, entrepreneurs, founders, leaders, management that are in the disaster restoration, fire, water, mold, reconstruction, bio could be in there a little bit. But we don't really teach, coach, and mentor on the technical side. We don't teach people how to dry. There are a lot of places that do that way better. We like to help people become better business owners, and specifically owners that have a vision of what they're going to do when they become successful, or what they're goal-oriented people. And we love freedom. So I don't believe a company should be a prison. We don't believe that it should burn you out, create, you know, divorce, bankruptcy, alcoholism, drugs. We think that it should be, we believe that more money, more giving. We believe in generosity. And the more you're successful you are, the more you can offer giving in other ways. And so that's our filter in how we onboard customers or even vet who we work for. We're like, where are you trying to go? And you've had a few on. Chad Sheehan was on your podcast from WCC in Wyoming, and a past client. We helped him with about a two-year period to get through some hurdles and solidify his vision. And I would think he's probably living it right now. He's very much into living his dream. And that's what we like to do. But it's business acumen. But it's also, you know, weaving into that, there's leadership, there's culture, there's SOPs, and creating a business that's actually valuable, so that if something does happen to you, if you decide to aid on a Friday when you're not getting paid by State Farm, you want to quit and sell it. Well, it's easier to know when you've got your business closer to that date than waiting 3 years to get it there. So those are some of the tenets that we work on with people.
Yeah. Yeah. So for those of you that are listening, if you're, especially if you're trying to get into the restoration space, like, I don't know that Clark does any coaching outside of restoration at all, but what he does primarily is business coaching, and they do that really well. And they help you understand who you are, and they help you understand where your company sits right now. So if you don't have processes in place, he's going to have that conversation with you. And he's going to say, okay, listen, this is something that you need to establish. And they've done a really good job of that, implementing some operational systems that help you become the ROS, right? The Restoration Operation System, or Operational System.
Mm-hmm. Restoration Operating System, which is we specifically created that from, we were EOS coaches for a while. We were definitely implementers. And we just found that there was some specificity that our industry is dynamic enough that we said, how can we make this more specific and niche? We love to niche down. And ROS is just that. It's for restoration or adjacent. Really, any trade company. We don't specifically market for trades, but it could be. If a plumber came to me and said, we're a mess, it's chaotic, help me clean it up, I think we could
do some. Would it then be called a POS?
I've owned a few POS. It could be. I've had a few Cutlass POS, yeah.
Yeah, but so, like, for those of you that are listening, like, Clark is, and Clark, this is 100% permission for you to just plug the crap out of your company right now in terms of what you do. For anybody that's listening that you know, you're on this journey, you're thinking about this journey, I would suggest, because I did this, you don't do this on your own. Doing it on your own is difficult, and trying to navigate and bump through the things. It's the whole reason we created this podcast, is so that we could help you not have to bang your head against the wall. Clark is one of those people that has helped a lot of people. Even Chad would sing your praises in regard to, you know, he's not currently a client, but you helped him get where he needed to be to move his thing forward. And it's created some success for him. And there's others that we've had on that would also sing your praises. Clark has always been a valuable resource to me, and helpful, and a friend. And so, you know, one of the things that I would say is, you know, Clark can be huge in helping you identify some things. And so certainly set up to go find him and locate him and make some connections. Because what we know is, and we had some conversation before we start recording, we always have a little bit of chit chat and banter. And one of the things Clark said is, you know, the playbook that you had last year may not work this year. And he knows how to help you pivot that sort of thing. If you're in that spot where you're looking and saying, hey man, something's just not working anymore. Something's not flowing the way it needs to. Let's talk about that, Clark. What's happening in the restoration space right now?
Well, the other stakeholders, the economy, and all the other components that swivel around this ecosystem have agreed that they're not going to sit still and say the same. So I would start with the insurance company. That's the real easy target. We don't work for the insurance company. Well, some people do. Some people are on programs or associated in partnerships with them. And that certainly affects them in more of a way than someone that's not. But even if you're independent, you're affected by the ecosystem of the bigger entity. Insurance companies are a business. I tell people all the time that you can run a restoration company, but you better be a business that has restoration. Don't identify as a drying god. That's great, but that's not going to, you know, when you're 52, you're going to be like, man, I'm still just a 30-year master restorer, but I don't have a business that without me it lasts. Insurance companies have, and this has been going on, Clint, you and I both, they don't stay the same, but they've shifted. They don't like paying out claims, which who would? That's not how they make profit. But and delay, deny, defend is a big playbook for anyone that's watching this, never grabbed it. It might be interesting to read. But I think in the last couple of years, between events and storms, state regulations, they have been taking it on the chin in what they consider not to be as profitable years. And that's not acceptable to them. It's binary. Business is binary to insurance companies. Do they care about their customers? Probably to some degree. But they have changed their policies. And I'm talking about their written insurance policies that homeowners, myself, we're homeowners and we have insurance policies to make those more affordable because the costs have gone through the roof, maybe post-COVID, if you wanted to blame something, but just inflation. And to make that more desirable or achievable for a homeowner to live in this real estate bubble, policies have changed to have less coverage, caps, exclusions, deductibles have, we've seen a lot of the 2-3% of a home value. Listen, a home value of $500,000-$600,000 with a 3% deductible. I'm no math god, but $18,000 is a lot for a common homeowner who's never seen this before to fathom that we or anybody coming in their house might cost enough to make that worth it. Agents have not been quite as good at helping their insured through these debacles. So I think those are some of the plays. I think there have been some states specific that have legislation that have been, I think Florida might be the easy one to pick out. I think there's been a lot of shifts into those things. And we are usually on the reactive side as a part of that. Because like I said, we bill a homeowner or business owner, but they often depend on the promise of an insurance company. And then that's where things get tricky. And there are laws around what we can and cannot do to participate in that. But I just think it's gotten harder. I think, Clint, you and I will agree. I've been talking the last 3 or 4 months at a few different events, the RIA and RTI with Lisa Lavender and a few other places. And we're talking about the shifts, and I'm listening to the audience. Anyone that's been in this business 10 years will say it didn't used to be quite as adversarial. There was a real professional camaraderie between stakeholders, even if we weren't contractually connected, to have conversations about what the real cost or the real outcome should look like. And that has dwindled. Maybe that's because of TPAs. Maybe that's just because of real adjusters with experience have, you know, moved on to something else. I don't know. Maybe a combination of all those. But what I found to your question is we are still trying to, in some ways, hope that it either returns or stay in the 2011 era or before 2009. And, I'm just finding people banging their head against stone wall saying, this isn't working. I said, it's just like I play baseball. Sports change. I'm an Aggie. Go Aggies, you know, 10-0. Well, you can't, I know I was going to get something out of you for that, but last year's team that you're playing against on the field, they've revamped their playbook, and you had better, if you want to compete and win and achieve and grow and get satisfaction, you have to do the same thing. And I think that's something in our world. And that's uncomfortable for people. We both know how change can feel, especially when you're the only one doing it. And so those are some of the conversations that we are confronting with people and exploring. We have some very tried and true things that are working, but some of them are drastically different than what the norm looks like. And that's met with hesitation from a lot of the industry and all. But slowly, as more people start to reach out and do things different, you know, we have a lot of plumbing companies that are becoming restorers, and they're performing differently. They just, the way their infrastructure works, they have a different model, and it's interesting. And I think more of that happens, it gives a lot of people permission to say, oh, okay, let's change something. So that's kind of where my head's at right now, is looking for solutions to the boulders in the road that we're coming up on.
Well, and we've started watching, and like I've been having conversations for the last 6 months, maybe a year at this point, that saying, listen, you know, in DFW, right? Specifically in DFW, a house a decade ago that was worth $300,000 is now worth $600,000. And like you said, now it's going to a 3% deductible. So a decade ago, whenever I was having a claim and I had a loss, I had maybe a $2,000 deductible. Well, the homeowner can absorb that scenario and know that we're going to come in and we're going to save the day and we're going to help them get what they need to get. But now that it's $18,000 first, I got to pay $18,000 out of pocket first. That's my obligation before insurance is going to step in at all. Then they're more hesitant to do anything. And the perception for the customer is, the only thing that's really wet is my carpet, right? So like, you know, the carpet's wet and the wood floors, I wiped it all up. It's all going to be fine. I think we're going to have a resurgence of the mold industry pretty significantly, because the result is we're not getting structures dry because people are panicking about the deductibles. Now, if insurance companies have eliminated mold coverage, then that puts us back in a position where, you know, who knows what's going to happen. But you know, 2001, insurance companies left the state of Texas because they didn't want to cover mold, because they wanted to be able to then write it into the premium. So it's interesting what's going to happen. And I'm with you. So as a company, not the job doc software said, not business aspers I, but as Mr. Restore, we've started figuring out, okay, we've got to pivot. We've got to pivot. We need to change exactly how we do this, see what we can bring forward, and not just be beholden to somebody's going to have a loss and they're going to have that money to, you know, write the check for, or only address massive significant losses, because things have to happen for some of the smaller stuff too. I mean, you get a $500,000 structure fire because there was a lightning strike. People are going to address that. Like, they know they're going to move forward on that regardless of what the deductible is. Speaking of lightning strike, maybe we'll hear the thunder roll through in a second.
You told me you had some weather today.
There's some weather today, which is, at least it partly feels like fall now, because it's been 80 degrees the last week in mid-November, which is not okay. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, so if people are going to have to pivot then and find something new, what is it that Clark Brown and Restoration Advisors is doing to help clients start looking at that? Or what are you guys researching to be able to implement for your clients that exist? What is something you would want to say to the restoration industry right now about, you need to be looking at this?
Yeah. So we have really put a lot of focus on, and let me back up for just a second. You talk about pivoting. After COVID, our industry, all industry, trade service industries went through a little bit of a spiral. I think ultimately a lot of people said they ended up being better than, you know, than they thought. We, as coaches, consultant, educator is really what I consider myself to be. We pivoted into online courses. We figured there was a lot of people that weren't traveling, limited funds of unknown revenue. So I didn't know how to do online courses. I made a few. They were awful. They were god awful. They're probably great for the Smithsonian to look at how not to do it. But we now have worked at it, chipped away, and perfected. And we have, for those people that are DIY that say, I just want to consume a course, we have some great, great online courses. Now, those spin off into training programs that we can do live or individual with companies. And it's an asset and a resource that we can get multiple diversified uses out of. But for the last 2 years, Clint, seeing what we just talked about, seeing that, and I have some experience as a consultant with a very, very large multi-service company out here on the East Coast, $300 million, that had all trades, plumbing, electrical, HVAC, and then restoration. And we had what is close to be as a restoration company that was a retail restoration company, client-facing 100%. Price the jobs up front, get an agreement with the client, no estimator, the lead tech or the project manager was, you know, the plumber that would go out, would give you a price. And that, people say, there's no way it worked. And I said, well, it did. And it did. So I think that what you just said, mold especially, which isn't covered, restoration companies need to become a little better at selling their value of sales. And I think that, I'm not a sales coach, but I don't think that restoration services require a ton of sale. I think it's educating, and I think it's consequences if you don't, what happened, and then you've got to build trust. You should be working on your reviews, testimonials. You should have a YouTube channel and a podcast in your market so everyone sees you as an expert. So that retail mindset shift has been one big thing. And then how to set yourself apart from everybody else. And then another big program that I think has really moved the needle for us as a company, as a niche, and our clients. Now, you talk, not everyone becomes a client. Sometimes they're just a student. They attend a course. They buy a course or something. But that's been what we call our customer onboarding. We started noticing a lot of the problems we had with our getting paid in full, having the customer understand the expectations, agreed upon pricing, all of those things, which you and I know from the commercial world, we kind of set up front. But in the residential side, it was a blank work authorization. We'll send the insurance company your bill at the end, and we'll take what we get. Well, that doesn't work. So we started client onboarding, which was a front-end process system of thinking like a retail company, like you're a service trade company. We're going to give you a price up front. Yes, you can do that. People say you can't. You can give a ROM. You can give a rough order magnitude, very common language in your contract that says change orders might be there, but you're going to give them expectations, how long it's going to take, assumed, what it's going to sound like, smell like, feel like, what they might come across, what to expect. And we have found that that's a trust builder with expectations and transparency. And then when you have back end conflict from maybe an insurance company or a stakeholder of property management, you've already planted your position and agreed upon. And normal, average, good humans will say, we make an agreement, we're going to stick to it. If they don't, hopefully you catch that in the beginning and find out this is probably not a person of character that you want to work with, which is another side product of it.
Yeah.
That has been a very tough boulder to push uphill, but we have grown it. We are now getting referrals from people who say, hey, if you're having problems getting paid and all these kinds of symptoms, Clark, Toby at Restoration Advisors, the one. And that's kind of what we wanted. We wanted to become a subject matter expert on one of the bigger things in our industry. And we just held a class live here in Richmond. We love small classes, 30 people, brains, just the conversations and the oohs and ahs coming out and the people writing and asking us to repeat stuff. It was great. So I think that that is going to continue to be, if we can, and I want other coaches to grab that information and grab that mindset. Because if we, as an industry, if we start thinking differently, it gets easier for everybody.
Yeah, all boats rise with the tide, right? We're all rowing the same direction, we all have the same mentality, then yeah, absolutely, that's valuable.
So that's something I've been real passionate about. And I think it addresses some change, but there's others. But I think it's one to prepare us maybe a little more conditioning for the next change.
Yeah. So you said something about client onboarding. And for some of us, and in a lot of cases for the entrepreneur that's creating this company, they have the capacity to do that. They might need some training there, but that leads to my thought of employees. And it talks about employee quality and employee retention and employee maturity. So talk a little bit about that, because you're trying to onboard somebody for an unknown dollar amount and setting up for, we're going to do these things and provide this service in your property. How do you go vet these employees out? How important do you think it is? Like, let's talk about your concept around right people, right seats, and navigate a little bit of that, because I think that's significant too.
That is. And that's along with who you are, your vision on who we want to be and who we won't be, people become very much the next. Processes are second after the right people. And from that one interchange of that one big company, you have to, in the changes that we're talking about, different playbooks, we need to start hiring different types of frontline people. I'm of the belief, and I think you and I share this, I know Kevin Dooley and I share, the most important person in your company is your lead, your front forward facing customer technician. And when you can hire, and that a lot of things go into that, you have to be profitable. You have to shift on who does what and reallocate overhead. Unfortunately, you might get rid of a few middle managers because you're going to hire people of a higher caliber, coachable, teachable, hungry for skills, and you pay them more. And when you start paying people a really good living wage, watch them ask you how they can grow more, what else they can do. And that's been the thing. That's our industry is not where I'd like to see it as how we label technicians. A lot of people look at technicians because of the rate that insurance has kind of mandated. They're very much little more than laborer. You know, you've got some skills, but even people that have been WRT, ASD, and others, they're just there doing the minimal work where other parties that aren't always billable in the Xactimate world, especially. And I think that we can just really have new conversations, maybe use a little bit of that model that I had, whether or not you have a big $300 million year company, that could be scaled down. But I think your people need to be very independent minded, meaning like I will self-learn, I will read, I will absorb, I will chase education. I will ask you and beg you for more opportunity. They need to want more of themselves and others, and they have to be team-minded and not put up with mediocrity from others. Those are hard to find. But I think that at $21 an hour, the people we're trying to get, that's not a living wage. So I think we need to really look at how we could grow that and move it into getting people to a living wage where they would go home and tell their wife or their husband and their siblings, man, I've got such an opportunity. I can't wait. Because we know that this industry, plumbers, HVAC, we could be $100 an hour lead techs. I mean, $100,000 a year income is not inconceivable for a very high performing driven person. I had a guy that worked for me before. He was a teacher before, and he became one of our best lead technicians. He said, I got tired of teaching. I wanted to do something tangible with my hands that I could be, even if it's hard work, I don't mind it. And he goes, but I want to have control of what I can make. It's aside from being in a stuck position where I'm making this, except this. So he was over 100 a year, and he had a year and a half experience, a lot of training. That's a lot of it. Luke, you know, Clint, is you're going to have to train differently. You're going to have to get away from so many of the how many air movers and start thinking about overcoming objections, getting trust, your standards with customers, those types of things, and reading people, soft skills. And there are a lot of coaches in our space. A lot of people teach soft skills. I think we need more of that. Not just buzzwords like culture and leadership specifically. Like get some personality assessment training with people so they can read a person and understand, oh, this is a D personality. This is an alpha. I've got to know how to get what I need done, but I've got to know that that person is probably going to think they know more than me. And I've got to play with that instead of putting up a wall. And that's harder with younger people.
Sure.
Our younger generation are not continuing.
And at some level, it's difficult to just get the quality of individual that you need as a technician because the industry is predicated that you can't charge enough to pay that person what you need to pay them. So the way the industry is structured right now, mm-hmm. if you get somebody and pay them what they're worth, you're losing money every time they are working.
Yeah.
Just because the industry doesn't want to pay you what they're worth. You've got to navigate how to make that work.
I want people listening to hear this, if nothing else. Fast forward to this moment in the podcast. We have clients and we have people that are not clients that I know that are, by the way, this is a whole different podcast, all T&M. On all losses, that bill for a lead tech close to $100 an hour, which affords them to pay someone 31 to 32 plus. You've got to know your numbers. You've got to shrink your overhead so that you don't. And you can do that when you eliminate other positions and put that over into this person. But it is. I want everyone to know, don't say it's not possible because it is. It just might not be in your viewfinder, in your glasses. But it means some things need to change. And everybody listening to this, no matter what relationships you're in, or what program TPA, you still own your business, whether it's an LLC or an S Corp. You still have complete control to start the journey to say 2028, I want to be looking differently. I want to brand differently. I want to whatever. Not like this is the way we've always done it. It's a killer for small businesses, right?
Yeah, so, absolutely.
But I want people to know that there are people out there exampling that think differently that are paving the way. And I think that, and what I love to do is show other people those people. I like to introduce and facilitate those people in the same room, explore what they're doing, what's possible in their market. And but I think that's the disabling belief, limited belief systems that a lot of people have. And I think that's put us where we are to some degree in this industry. Yeah.
I'm glad I asked that question and made that statement because this is what I wanted to get out of you. There are some of these things where you're having this conversation from a different perspective than the majority of the restoration space operates from right now, because you've had that experience and you've kind of seen these things and you're working with different clients to know what the different pushbacks and hiccups have been along the path, right? Mm-hmm. So I want people to see that there are individuals out there like Clark that can help you evaluate exactly where you're at and change the game plan. Like, we need to rewrite the plays, because the plays that we had from 2020, right before COVID, don't work. The plays that we had from 2008, when you first got into the restoration space, they don't work. Even these guys that are running these massive restoration guys, these guys that are doing $50 and $100 million in restoration, it's not the same game for them either. And it's a bigger issue for them to pivot, because now they're trying to navigate, okay, I've got this massive overhead and they're trying to make these changes to what the industry is doing. And it's difficult. So I'm glad you said that, because it's a perfect perspective.
And I think we can add in the complexity in the last 3 or 4 years of the private equity and mergers and that M&A funding that's come into our industry, creating conglomerates, which buys a lot of marketing dollars, which makes things difficult. But I am seeing clear signs where the M&A private equity is not rainbowing like they thought it was. And I've seen some crumbling of a little bit of the energy around that, which might be good for some people, not for those that have gotten it acquired. I've got some great friends and partners that have had acquisitions, and they just, you know, it's not what they expected, but it is what it is. So I think that has added to it a lot. You know, Clint, I think you're the same. You're very well traveled. You go to a lot of conferences and events. I budget every year about $80,000 for travel and events. And those are my education. Those are personal and professional development. And I go to not only the big industry events, but I go to a lot of things outside of our space for other entrepreneur groups. And I find it to be a responsibility that what I learned to bring back and share with this industry, which has given me the life and the career that I have. I believe in, you have three phases in life: learn, earn, and return. And I think I'm in the return phase, and I get reward from that. But people like you and me and hundreds of others listening and watching, it's okay to share what you learn with everyone else, because it's first of all, you look like a giving person and you're attractive. You feel better, and your team, your employees look at generosity, and then they will portray that as well. So those are some of my personal beliefs around learning, but I spend an obscene amount of money, but I know what the ROI is long-term. And I think you share that a little bit with me.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. I think it's important that we give first. Like, that's one of the things that we do both in the restoration company and the software company, is we're trying to give first, knowing that it's going to pay us back. And if it doesn't, that's fine. We're still doing the right thing for the right reason. Mm-hmm. And I think that's valuable. Even if it's, you know, educating, in your case, part of what you're giving first is to educate the space. And educating the space helps, which is exactly what we're trying to do here. Educating the space helps the entire industry, on the entire entrepreneurial world, to grow and develop. And that gets all of us a better opportunity to be successful, to learn more, to be more efficient, to make more money being successful, but then at the same time, causing an elevation of all the industry as a whole. And yeah, if we can do that, then we can be successful, because there's things we're going to have to come together on, regardless if we're competitors or not, in order to make the whole thing more valuable for all of us.
Well, I think other industries, and I've looked at a lot of other trades and industries outside of even service, I feel like there were times in our industry in the restoration space where our walls were tall and thick, but I look at other trades and they kind of collaborate in a different way for just what you're saying. Competitors don't see each other necessarily as competitors. I've had several group dinners in Dallas-Fort Worth with you involved, and when you get a table or a room full of people at a great barbecue or Mexican restaurant, magical things happen. And Clint, I want to share with you briefly. I was in Memphis a month ago, and I was sitting at a table with a man and a husband and wife asking my story. I spoke, and they're like, tell us more about you. Sold my company. And they said, why did you not get back into this, buy another restoration company? And I said, first of all, I kind of was bored with it. I get bored really easy, and that wasn't firing me up. But I also had learned that when you do a restoration project, you're helping one person, one family. What I have found that I've been able to do, and a good friend of mine is another consultant, said I get to help hundreds of people, social media, people that you've never met, which have a compound effect of they all get to affect 1,000 or 300 people a year. And I just found that the multiplication of that was far more rewarding for someone like me that really it looks to be a giver. And so, but you have that with this podcast. Everyone that has a podcast, if they really earnestly say, think about all the people that I'll never know that watch this, that might take a nugget and prove something. And then ask yourself, when it comes to that final day on this planet, was what I did worth it? You can look back and say, I think it was enough. Yeah. So that's kind of where I'm at. I know it's getting real high level and stuff there.
Yeah, but still. I mean, yeah. Then that leads into part of the conversation we had before. You know, was it worth it? Am I doing the right things for the right reason? Where am I at?
Yeah.
But and Clark, from that perspective, I applaud what you're doing. I appreciate you certainly as an industry individual and as a friend, what you're working toward, what you're accomplishing, your consistency, your honor, your loyalty throughout all of it. Dude, you've been an amazing part of this industry in this space. So I think you'll be able to look back and we'll all, you know, I mean, I'll probably die before you will, but you know, if I wasn't, then we'd stand around the casket and be like, man, this guy was a good dude. And he did a lot.
You're one tough mofo. I got to tell you what, you've been through some stuff that I wish I had some of your stuff, but Clint, I want to shift it to, again, maybe inspire people. I think a business is a tool and a vehicle for what's next. I think that your obligation to yourself, your family, your community, your employees is be profitable, be abundant, grow, not just to grow north, south, but east, west, and like have better impact. And I think that for a founder, for an owner, for leadership teams, or anyone, if I do this well, what else can I do? And for me, just like yourself, by the way, I loved your book, but I've been able to author 4 books and I have 11 more to keep going on. And that only happens when I structure and build a company that doesn't need me as its Google, ask me every question, ChatGPT Clark. And then it creates a new atmosphere and ecosystem where the books reach people, hit them a different way. They're fictional, they're fake parables, but people, it attracts more leads and opportunities and future partners. But I think that everyone here has bigger dreams than what they've got, but they just get stuck in where they are, they think is where they've got to stay. And it's just not. So you don't need permission. You don't have to be like any other colored truck in your market. You can actually, I deplore you, I beg you to be different and then showcase what that difference does. But I know yourself, you have big dreams, you have other ventures. I'm not a one-trick pony, and I certainly, if I can only do one thing, it's not going to work. But writing my books has been extremely creative and output and open for me. And I loved yours. I got a lot of inspiration from your book and your publishing it. And actually, we shared a publisher just because I like how they did your book.
Yeah.
So it's been fun. And I think it's just going to lead to more and more things. Like, I can't even fathom what might be next year.
Yeah. Well, it's super exciting. So what's the one piece of advice that you would give to any entrepreneur, whether they're trying to crest that next level or just get into entrepreneurship in general? What do you think? What's the most valuable thing you could say to them right now?
Very, very old and cliche, but get a tattoo on your arm that says you don't know everything. Every human, every person, every place is an opportunity if you walk in with it. Like, just what more? I mean, we watch people, and I think this is what leads me to this, Clint. Everybody listening to this probably can imagine someone in their market or in their industry that is doing better, whatever scale you want to mark and measure success on. They're somewhere you want to be, but that you don't perceive that they actually are as good at what they do as you. Probably not true, but talent is not enough. It's tenacity, it's effort. But learning, like, and being open to that. Like, I tell people all the time how to get out of trouble with a business choice, and they don't do it because they think they know better and they stay stuck. And that obviously that pains me. I would rather see somebody successful than to write a check or send a credit card payment over. That success is the payoff. The money is the bonus. But I would just say, don't be stubborn at all. And then adjacent to that, you said, you can't do it alone, whether it's a coach, whether it's a mentor, whether it's a friend or a colleague, a networking event, something. There are people that have mastered what you struggle with, lenient. But those are things that I would say that I see most often, that people say they're open to that, but they really aren't. They're guarded. Their identity is wrapped around who they are today. And I just think that that's a limitation to what's possible. And it's certainly what's going to be needed for some of the changes that we've talked about that are coming up.
Don't get in your own way. Like, don't be the cog in the wheel. Like, mm-hmm. be willing to learn those things. Go get the education and spend the time digging in on those things.
And if you don't know where to go, reach out to me or Clint and say, hey, yeah. I'm looking to learn a certain thing. I'm looking to overcome a certain thing. If we don't know, we probably know who does or where. I mean, we can at least start a breadcrumb trail to something else.
And we'll go figure out who knows it if we don't know the answer to it.
Right. For sure.
Because I'm the first to admit, I don't know all the answers. I mean, I call you about things on a regular basis. Like, hey, dude, you know, you call me. We have conversations. We talk to other people. Like, there are ways to navigate this.
I'm the smart guy you'll ever meet. I'm the dumbest smart guy you'll ever meet.
I generally tell people I'm a 90-second genius. Like, I can talk to you about anything for about 90 seconds, and then I'm going to have to walk away because then I'll start looking dumb. So
I love it. But I think confidence. Yeah, go ahead. I think confidence is big. I think everyone here needs to label themselves as gifted to what they do.
So, you know, one of the things you said, I was going to mention it and I just lost my brain for a minute, but now I'm back to it, is at some level, you have to be gritty, because if you see entrepreneurship is hard, restoration space is hard, really everything is hard. But if you are in a position where you're anxious about how hard it becomes and you're willing to quit easy and go back to work somewhere, you're going to quit quickly and easily. Like, if entrepreneurship is not for the weak of heart. And so based on part of what you're saying, it's like, look, you got to dig in. You got to be willing to realize you don't know everything, and you got to stick with it. You know, have some determination, have some grit about you and push through, you know?
If you keep going, you'll win, because 98% of people will quit before you. So if you just borrow, beg, steal, whatever you have to do to stay in the fight, others will quit. You'll take your break, and then you'll be up on top of the mountain alone. All the cliches in the world. I have a YouTube series that I've been filming for the last 3 months. It's called Mental Toughness. And I think mental toughness is what separates world class from others. And it's a whole thing. It's going to end up probably being 100 videos that are real short in 3 or 4 minutes. Motivation is not the thing, but I want to remind people that if you're working hard, hard things are going to happen. You're going to be confronted with friction if you're trying new stuff. You just got to push through, because that's what everybody that we watch and listen to, that we look up to, Elon, Cardone, all of the guys, Jocko, they all went through hard stuff. If we want to get to where they are or feel the way they feel, we're going to have to do some of what they did. And I think that's exactly what you just said. It's grit. And yeah. We're all better than we think. We're all stronger than we think we are. And you need to be circled around people.
You certainly do more than you think you can.
You got to be around people that tell you. You got to be around people that push you. Chad Turkett, you're a friend of mine, both of us. He sent me a message saying, man, if you don't believe you can do what you're supposed to do next, I can't believe you. Don't quit. He goes, because I'm watching and hoping you get it done. So that's the kind of people you need in your life.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Is the motivational stuff out yet? At any capacity? Yeah. Okay.
I'll send you the link to that playlist on my big YouTube channel. We have a podcast, but
when we send out the email, we'll make sure that link is included.
Hey, I want to tell everyone else, do we have a second longer? Something very, very excited about. Talking about what I've been able to build my business to do. I mean, I have a lot of passions. I love to go to Montana and hang out. My business allows me to do that. But I just got back last weekend from 10 days in Jamaica. I am associated with a lot of nonprofits. Again, falls into my giving. And how can I use my disaster management, project management mind to help in times of needs? And we go to every storm that there is. Well, I'm part of a nonprofit. I'm the logistics director for USDR, United Survivors Disaster Relief. And that group is very domestic based, but Jamaica had a bunch of our affiliated partners. We have some other larger mega groups that were down there. And they just said, we need more skilled people that know this, can maneuver this environment. So I went for a couple, 9 days and a half, including travel, helped feed some people, helped with aerial helicopter deliveries, helped connect the local, they have something called MPs, members of parliament, which are like their small little governors or communities. And just like connected people to other people that have things that they need and just kind of freed up the aid distribution. I can tell everyone listening that if you get to a point where you want to be reminded why we do what we do and why we built all this skills, acumen, grit that we had, go start helping people using that can't ever consider paying you a dime, and you will come back home. You will come back to your team. And if you took your team with you, you will have a new outlook on what it is we do and how important it is. And you won't have a problem charging people that have the insurance companies or whoever, they have the money to do it. You'll remember how valuable it is, what you have, not in an egotistical way, but in a pride, yeah, a healthy pride. And so I had great time in Jamaica. I hope and pray that can go back maybe a week or two. They're certainly still in the middle of it. And when the camera shut down and the next media cycle turns around, it's going to get harder down there because they're already a very, very poor country. But I was proven when I was there that maybe this is what I was meant to do. Really want to get high level and kind of spiritual with everyone. And even my team said, Clark, you do better work when you do that stuff and come back because you're energized, you're creative, you're driven, you're on fire. So maybe that's my therapy. And I recommend anyone in the States or abroad, find an organization, Samaritan's Purse, any of those, Rubicon. They all need volunteers. And we have built-in skill sets that place us in comfortable positions where we're not afraid to go into a place with no food, no water, no internet. So they need people like us for people who don't know what to do next. So I really would encourage anyone, contact me. I can connect you with some things. But 3, 4, 5 days for anyone, it will change your quarter, change your year. And so, but you've got to build your business where it doesn't depend on you, where it doesn't miss you for that period. That's kind of the full circle of what I was talking
about. Yeah. And so awesome. And you've done great.
Yeah, buddy.
All right, man. We're at 50 minutes now. I appreciate you being on. I don't want to keep you all day, but I am so grateful for the friendship, brother, and the phone calls and text messages and for joining us today on the podcast.
Well, I can't wait to see you next time. I don't know, probably be in the spring. I'm actually coming to Dallas in January. I'll look you up. We'll have lunch.
Maybe we'll have some food.
We'll get with Nick and we'll have a meal with all three of us or something like that.
Yeah, let's do it.
But you be careful. Thanks for everyone watching.
Yeah, man.
Keep going. Don't stop. You're worth it. You're enough. Just figure out what you need to do next. And maybe it's not what you've done before. And just be okay with that.
Perfect. Well said.
See you later.